Welcome to Bruderhof Radio. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
When you're flying a high-level mission, you drop bombs and you really don't know what's going on. You certainly don't see people. You don't see, hear screams. You don't see blood. You don't see the human devastation that you cause. And as for the public, the public is given pictures on television which sort of look like a pinball machine gone wild, with lights flashing, and sort of satisfied statements from the military commanders that they've hit such and such targets.
In the following program, historian Howard Zinn discusses the deception and media manipulation used in reporting NATO's ongoing bombing of Yugoslavia. Drawing on his own experience as a high-altitude bomber for the United States Air Force in Europe during World War II, Zinn emphasizes that whenever you start dropping bombs, civilians are going to die, regardless of the accuracy of these weapons. NATO, he says, has failed to inform the public of the magnitude of the damage they are causing in Eastern Europe. But Zinn does more than question the credibility of reporting. He questions the morality of the bombing itself. What makes human rights abuses in Kosovo any different from human rights abuses in Rwanda or Colombia? Why are violations by Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic termed ethnic cleansing and genocide, while similar violations, like those of former Indonesian President Suharto, are only called alleged human rights abuses? Is the bombing of Yugoslavia a last-ditch effort by the United States to assert its imperialist interest in Eastern Europe and to maintain a rationale for the existence of NATO? To answer these questions, Zinn examines the past and uncovers a long tradition of deception and media manipulation in U.S. foreign policy. This war, he says, is no different. We asked Zinn why NATO was bombing Yugoslavia.
I wish I knew exactly, but because you're right, there's no sort of immediate economic interest. I mean, some people have pointed to, you know, coal in the Kosovo region or, you know, or pipelines and control of pipelines and oil. But none of that seems very convincing, although, you know, very often we get into military intervention when there's no immediate economic interest, but where the strategists in Washington see some long-term economic interest. I'm thinking of Vietnam, where there was no immediate economic interest for the United States to be involved in Vietnam, but when you read the memos of the National Security Council in the early 1950s about why the United States is interested in Indochina, you see they keep talking about the oil, the rubber, the tin, not of Vietnam, but of the whole area. And so if you look at it that way and think in their ways of, you know, geopolitical problems, then you extend the boundaries of concern beyond Kosovo, and then it takes in the Caspian Sea and the oil deposits around it. So that's one possibility. But a stronger possibility, it seems to me, is simply that the necessity for NATO to maintain its existence, to maintain the rationale for its existence. And because, after all, NATO was set up originally after World War II, presumably to guard against a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Now, in fact, that was not a real threat. I mean, the Soviet Union was a real threat to Eastern Europe. Later on, it was a real threat in Afghanistan. But it was never a real threat to Western Europe, and yet NATO was set up for that purpose. And in other words, it was set up for a purpose which to guard against a danger which didn't exist, and it was unable to do anything about dangers which did exist, that it was unable to do anything about the Soviet Union having control of Eastern Europe and sending troops into Czechoslovakia or Hungary or Afghanistan. And so the NATO never really had a reason for existence, and now with the disintegration of the Soviet Union since 1989 or so, there's even not even the ghost of a reason, not even the claimed reason for existence. And yet they want to maintain NATO, want to maintain a military connection with other countries in which the United States is dominant, and which creates the rationale for maintaining a large military presence, which then can intervene in situations where necessity might be more evident than in Kosovo. In other words, Kosovo may be a kind of exercise for NATO, especially with NATO expanded now with the addition of, you know, Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia. Here is an opportunity for expanded NATO to show its power and to augment its military forces, to try out its weaponry, and I might add an opportunity for military contractors to make an awful lot of money. I recall that when the expansion of NATO was being debated, there was a lobbying organization in Washington arguing for the expansion, and the head of the lobbying organization was also the head of one of the United States' leading aircraft companies. So, I mean, that's as close as I can come to explaining this, what seems to me an irrational as well as immoral decision to bomb the hell out of Yugoslavia, including Kosovo.
What Zinn finds most disturbing is NATO's assertion that the bombing is actually disabling the Serbian military without adversely affecting the civilian population. NATO has admitted to a few accidents, like the April 27th incident in which a stray missile exploded in a Serbian village, killing at least 20 people, according to the New York Times. Nevertheless, Zinn feels that much more civilian death may actually be taking place, given the nature of modern warfare. Flying, as NATO pilots are, at around 50,000 feet, it would be almost impossible to avoid destruction of civilian life and property, even if so-called smart bombs were the only weapons used.
Well, it's certainly true that air war is invisible. That is, it's invisible both to the people who fly the missions and to the public outside. That is, the people who fly the missions, unless they're flying low-level missions in which they can see exactly what they're doing, when they're flying high-level missions, and the missions in Kosovo are high-level missions because they don't want to risk losing aircraft, when you're flying a high-level mission, you drop bombs and you really don't know what's going on. You certainly don't see people, you don't see, hear screams, you don't see blood, you don't see the human devastation that you cause. And as for the public, the public is given pictures on television which sort of look like a pinball machine gone wild, with lights flashing and sort of satisfied statements from the military commanders that they've hit such and such targets. And, I mean, for instance, right now in the bombing of Yugoslavia, we are getting very, very little information about the havoc which is being caused to human beings as a result of our bombing. Now, presumably, we have flown a couple of thousand sorties over Yugoslavia. Now, even if you assume that in each sortie only one person was killed, that's several thousand people who have died. Now, the American public at this point has no notion of how many people have been killed as a result of our bombing, and I suspect that the actual numbers are far, far greater than we have even led to believe. We just get little glimpses of what they call accidents, which of course are not accidents because they're inevitabilities, and that is the bombing of civilian targets. And I've been getting email messages from various people, including people in Belgrade, who say that schools have been bombed, hospitals have been bombed, cultural centers have been bombed. We know that neighborhoods have been bombed, villages have been bombed, and to simply talk about the bombing as being directed at military targets is a huge lie. I mean, I can say this about accuracy and smart bombs. I mean, of course, the bombing has become much more sophisticated since I was in a B-17 using the Norden bomb site. But, you know, there's something comparable in both situations, and that is at that time, the Norden bomb site was looked upon as a smart weapon, and it was supposed to be able to drop bombs within a pickle barrel. Well, of course, that was nonsense. When we used the Norden bomb site, the most sophisticated machine there was for aiming bombs, our bombs went all over the place and killed huge numbers of civilians. And we know from what NATO spokesmen themselves say and what people in the Pentagon say that so-called smart bombs only constitute a small portion of the total arsenal of bombs. In other words, most of the bombs are not smart but dumb, and even the smart bombs are not very smart, because the smart bombs, they will claim, well, are accurate 70 or 80% of the time. Then what happens to the 20% or 30% do not go where they're supposed to go? Those are the bombs that will fall on houses, on hospitals, on places that presumably were not intended to be bombed. So, you know, all of the statements made by the NATO spokesman and by the United States leaders, you know, about smart bombs and we didn't mean this as an accident, it's simply nonsense. As soon as you drop bombs, no matter how smart they are, under conditions where wind velocities are unpredictable, where mechanical problems always exist, where weather is a problem, you are going to drop bombs all over the place and kill an awful lot of people. And I might add one other thing. The designation of military targets is something that should be looked upon with suspicion, because they can designate anything as a military target, even though it houses civilians. And I'm thinking of the bombing that took place in Baghdad in the midst of the Gulf War, you know, where they did not claim it was an accident. They said they deliberately bombed this air raid shelter on the ground that it was a military target, killing, you know, 400 or 500, you know, men, women, and children. You know, I think all of those statements should be looked upon with enormous skepticism.
In 1945, after the nuclear bombing of the Japanese city of Hiroshima, Dwight MacDonald, then the editor of Politics magazine, wrote, "We must now conclude that the technical aspect of war is the evil, regardless of the political factors." According to Zinn, this statement holds true today and warrants closer examination in the context of Kosovo.
He was making a very perceptive point, and that is that the existence of advanced war technology creates an impetus towards war. And the existence of weapons creates the psychology that demands their use. I saw this myself when I was in the Air Force, and the war was almost over, and we bombed a little town on the Atlantic coast of France when there was absolutely no reason for a bombing because the war was almost over. But we had the bombs, we had the planes, we had the crews, and we had a new kind of bomb, a napalm, which we were anxious to try out. And so without any real reason, moral or political, for doing this, there was the kind of a technologically driven need to use the weaponry that we have. So I think that is still operating.
You're listening to Howard Zinn on Bruderhof Radio. We asked Zinn why the United States became involved in the situation in Kosovo, ostensibly to stop ethnic cleansing perpetrated by the Serbs against ethnic Albanians, while at the same time ignoring similar mass human rights abuse in Chiapas, Mexico, East Timor, and Rwanda. His reply indicts the media as much as the U.S. government. But what about the American people? Do they buy into the media's biased coverage? In an op-ed piece in the New York Times in mid-April, Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense in the 1980s under President Reagan, wrote that Americans are a compassionate people who understand that our peculiar status in the world, our enormous military and economic strength, carries obligations to rectify injustices of this kind in areas of vital concern to us. This may be true, says Zinn, but the problem is that it is the government, not the American people, who define which areas are of vital concern and which are not.
You know, I think most Americans do care about what happens to people in other countries, and they are moved by what they see as terrible things done to people. The problem is that the political leaders and the media together have a very selective view of what humanitarian problems require intervention. And so, and Caspar Weinberger is sort of an interesting spokesperson in this regard, because after all, the Reagan administration not only ignored violations of human rights in Guatemala and El Salvador and the Philippines and Indonesia, but it aided and abetted and gave military supplies to the people who were violating those and the regimes that were violating those human rights. So the American public, I believe, has genuine humanitarian concerns, but it continues to be misinformed about where people in the world are suffering, and misinformed about the ways in which the United States government ignores the suffering that goes on in two, three, four, five different places in the world and focuses on one particular target. Even though the polls show that the majority of the public favors what's going on, that percentage is usually given at around 65%, which means the 35% are opposed, or at least not in favor. And considering the fact that the information given to the public is sort of 95 or 98% in support of the bombing, it's remarkable that even 35% of the public would not support it. And my own experience speaking around the country about the Kosovo issue in various places, and not always to audiences that begin with a support for my position, but my experience is that the support for the bombing is a superficial one based on very, very little knowledge about what is going on. I mean, for instance, the public at large is not being told something that is now very, very clear, and that is the bombing has destroyed the opposition to Milosevic in Yugoslavia. So on the one hand, the United States says it wants to get rid of Milosevic. On the other hand, it carries out a policy which destroys the opposition to Milosevic. Now, if the public knew this, I think this might give them second thoughts about the bombing. If the public knew about the extent of civilian casualties that were inflicting, not on Milosevic or the people around him, but on ordinary people in Yugoslavia, this might give them pause, just as in the Vietnam War, when more and more Americans became aware of how many civilian Vietnamese Americans were killing in Vietnam. Well, I think that was an important factor in changing a public opinion on the war. So in my view, the 65% support for the war is superficial, based on lack of information. And if people can somehow be apprised of what is going on, of how the bombing has made things worse for the Kosovars, how we are bombing Kosovo even more than we are bombing the rest of Yugoslavia, apprised of what we are doing to the opposition, I think that then we'd begin to see a change in public opinion with regard to support of the war.
In his work as a historian, Zinn has dedicated much of his time to informing the public about the side of American history which standard texts have ignored. He says that the current conflict is no different from numerous other events in America's long history of foreign intervention.
Well, remember that when the British writer Philip Knightley wrote his book, The First Casualty, meaning that the first casualty of war is the truth. He was talking about World War One. I mean, lies necessarily accompany war, because since wars are based on deceiving the public in order to justify sending their young men into war, you inevitably have an association between deception and war. I mean, in the United States, you can go back to the Mexican War, and you can find that the President of the United States, Polk, deceived the American people about the origins of the Mexican War, and telling them that American blood had been shed upon American soil, and it was not American soil at all. It was disputed land between the Mexicans and Americans. So the Mexican War begins with a lie. War in Spain begins with a great deception about the Maine. Battleship Maine is exploded in Havana Harbor, and immediately the word goes out that the Spanish are responsible, and therefore we must go to war. In fact, no one knew what was responsible for the explosion in the Maine, and many, many, many years later, an investigation led by Admiral Rickover discloses that, in fact, there was a problem with the engine in the Maine, which led to the explosion. But there, too, it was a deception of the American public that justified the American intervention. Every war has been accompanied by that kind of deception. In World War One, the public was deceived about, for instance, the sinking of the Lusitania by the Germans, and this was looked upon as an unprovoked atrocity, that the Lusitania was a passenger vessel, and therefore the Germans had no military rationale for torpedoing it. In fact, Lusitania, turned out later, was carrying huge supplies of munitions, and therefore was part of the war. But that, and the sinking of other merchant vessels, became an occasion and a reason for the United States getting into the war. In World War II, it's known that President Roosevelt misled the American public in a number of instances in order to really push the nation closer to war, and the public was misled about the amount of provocation, that had been directed at Japan. Leading up to Pearl Harbor. Probably the most gross historical example of deception is the war in Vietnam. The lies just multiplied. And, the lie that we were going into Vietnam to save the Vietnamese from a North Vietnamese invasion, save the South Vietnamese from a North Vietnamese invasion, when in fact what was really happening was a rebellion in the South against the government that had been installed by the United States, which was helped by the North, but the North did not send any substantial number of troops in until the United States had very intensely escalated the war. And the lie that we were there to support the self-determination of the Vietnamese, when in fact we had supported the French in their desire to regain the colony of Vietnam and all of Indochina. And then, of course, in Vietnam, the claim that we were bombing only military targets, and over a million civilians were killed in Vietnam as a result of our bombing. I mean, Vietnam was just full of lies told to the American public to justify the continuation of a 10-year-long war.
You've been listening to the comments of historian Howard Zinn on NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. I am your host, Andrew Zimmerman, and thanks for joining us for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. Bruderhof Radio, which is produced by Andrew Zimmerman, is a project of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount. In particular, the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Instead of holding assets or property, we share everything in common, and each member gives his or her talents, time, and effort wherever they are needed. To obtain more information about Bruderhof Radio or the Bruderhof Communities, call 914-658-8351 or write to Woodcrest Bruderhof, Rifton, New York, 12471.